The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your healthcare provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And our first article today is about implanted heart devices and recent advances that have made them safer and more effective than ever. Your heart beats on average 60 to 100 beats every minute. That's 86,000 beats or more a day, and at least 31 million beats a year. By your 61st birthday, your heart has squeezed blood through its chambers billions of times. All of that can take a toll on the electrical system of the heart, says Abhishek Deshmukh, a cardiac electrophysiologist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Over time, parts of the heart can wear down. The heart's electrical system can become fatigued, lose cells, and fail to generate electrical signals. The heart wall can thicken, and heart cells can deteriorate. Diseased blood vessels can reduce blood supply to the heart, causing damage to the heart muscle. Eventually, these changes can increase the risk of erratic, skipped, or dangerously slow heartbeats, leading to dizziness, shortness of breath, fatigue, confusion, and passing out. In addition, a damaged heart may become weak, thickened, stiff, and unable to contract or relax as needed, a condition known as heart failure. Decades ago, when a person developed heart failure, or an irregular heartbeat known as arrhythmia, their time was limited, or they were in danger of sudden death. Then, during the mid-1900s, the pacemaker was developed. By delivering electrical impulses to the heart, this implantable device helps the heart beat in a consistent, healthy rhythm. Pacemakers and other life-sustaining implants can now reduce symptoms and add years or even decades to your life. Let's first look at those first-generation devices. The first wave of cardiac devices required people to strap a 10-ounce battery-powered pulse generator to their abdomens. It was about the size of a pocket radio. Flexible wires led from the device through openings in the chest or neck to the heart. There, electrical impulses from the device helped restore a natural rhythm. Today's high-tech devices have come a long way and continue to evolve and improve. They're much smaller and lighter. They can be implanted inside the body with no exposed wires or openings. The device's lithium batteries last up to 15 years. In addition, the devices can transmit signals via Bluetooth, allowing a healthcare team to monitor heart rhythm remotely. These battery-powered implanted devices include, one type is single and dual chamber pacemakers. These devices stimulate your heart when your heart's natural electrical system doesn't work as it should. Traditional pacemakers include a matchbook-sized pulse generator that sits just under the skin, near the collarbone. The generator is connected to flexible, insulated wires, known as leads, that carry electrical impulses from the generator to the heart muscle, helping it to beat in a regular rhythm. A single-chamber pacemaker includes only one lead. A dual-chamber pacemaker consists of two leads that stimulate the upper and lower chambers of one side of the heart. Then, there is cardiac resynchronization therapy, or CRT, devices. Also called biventricular pacemakers, these devices stimulate the two lower chambers of the heart, called ventricles. This helps the ventricles to beat in synchrony. Often used to treat heart failure, CRT devices help the heart squeeze more efficiently. And lastly, there are implantable cardioverter defibrillators, or ICDs. Similar to a pacemaker, these devices also detect life-threatening arrhythmias and shock or defibrillate the heart back into a natural rhythm when needed. While implanted devices can sustain life, they also pose some risks. The leads can become infected, necessitating their removal and replacement. They also can shift out of place. These dislodged leads fail to pace the intended area of the heart. They also can injure parts of the heart or stimulate tissues that aren't part of the heart. For example, if a dislodged lead stimulates the chest's phrenetic nerve, it can cause the diaphragm to twitch, triggering chronic hiccups. Finally, traditional pacing can cause the left side of the heart to weaken. This condition, known as pacing-induced cardiomyopathy, can cause heart failure. Mayo Clinic is one of many medical centers studying ways to reduce these risks while also increasing the effectiveness of these devices. That research has led to a new generation of devices and techniques to place leads. But before we go on to those new technologies, let's talk about what are some of the conditions for which these technologies apply. Implantable cardiac devices are used to treat the following conditions. 1. A slow heartbeat, known as bradycardia. If the heart's electrical system doesn't work effectively, the heart may get little or no command to pump, leading to a bradycardia or even a stop in the heart's electrical activity, known as asystole. Bradycardias may be continuous or they may come and go. Another condition for which these devices are used is heart failure. Despite its name, heart failure doesn't mean that the heart has come to a stop. Rather, people with heart failure have a weakened heart that can't contract or relax as well as needed. As a result, it may no longer pump enough blood for the body's needs, especially with demands such as movement and exercise. And finally, there are life-threatening arrhythmias. When the heart's electrical signals don't work correctly, the heart can beat irregularly. Sometimes this can lead to a dramatic drop in blood pressure. Someone's breathing and pulse may stop. Without an implantable device, this condition can lead to sudden death. So, now let's turn to those advances in pacing technology. During the past decade, implanted cardiac devices have become increasingly safer and more effective. Here's a look at some recent advances. So, one is conduction system pacing. Conventional pacemakers stimulate the lower right side of the heart. As the electrical impulse moves through the heart, there's a slight delay between contraction of the lower right and lower left chambers. That's an abnormal way to activate the heart, says Dr. Deshmukh. The contraction delay causes the left side of the heart to work harder than it ordinarily would. Over time, this increases a person's risk of developing pacemaker-induced cardiomyopathy and heart failure. In contrast, conduction system pacing lowers those risks by stimulating a different area. For this pacing, doctors called cardiac electrophysiologists place leads along an area of the heart that's part of the electrical conduction system. Because this area of the heart evolved to carry electrical impulses through the entire heart simultaneously, stimulating this location activates the heart in a way that is less likely to increase the risk of cardiomyopathy. We try to mimic the natural cardiac activation, which has been shown to have better results than conventional pacing, says Dr. Deshmukh. Secondly, there are leadless pacemakers. Leadless pacemakers involve no wires, so there's nothing to potentially shift out of place. The generator and leads are all part of the same pill-sized device. Cardiac electrophysiologists Insert these tiny devices by threading a catheter through a vein, typically the leg's femoral vein, and eventually into the heart. Because there's no chest incision, the risk of infection is lower than it is for traditional pacemakers with leads. Leadless pacemakers first became available nearly a decade ago. However, they were initially used to stimulate only one chamber of the heart, which increased the risk of pacemaker-induced cardiomyopathy. For this reason, medical professionals have begun using dual-chamber leadless devices. When one leadless pacemaker is placed in the upper part of the heart and another in the lower part of the heart, the upper and lower chambers of the heart will beat in synchrony. This reduces the risk of pacemaker-induced cardiomyopathy. Lastly, there are extravascular implantable cardioverter defibrillators. To place a traditional transvenous implantable cardioverter defibrillator, cardiac electrophysiologists insert a catheter into a vein to access the heart. Though the procedure is life-saving, it comes with a risk of infection and accidental damage to a blood vessel or the heart. Newer extravascular defibrillators reduce those risks. Additionally, their leads are placed outside of the heart. That allows cardiac electrophysiologists to insert the leads without using a blood vessel. That has been a game changer in people at higher risk of infection, such as people who are on dialysis or taking immune-suppressing medications, says Dr. Deshmukh. So it's important to understand your options. Though the newest pacing options can lower the risk of complications, they're not the right choice for everyone. For example, leadless pacemakers offer numerous advantages, especially for people in poor health or who may be immunocompromised. During recovery, there are also fewer restrictions on arm movements, making these devices an excellent option for people who use canes or walkers. But because the battery for a leadless pacemaker is placed inside the heart, it cannot be recharged or replaced. In contrast, the battery for a traditional pacemaker is located just under the skin near the collarbone. To replace it, a doctor makes a small incision, removes the pulse generator, and replaces it with a new one. A traditional pacemaker with leads may make more sense for someone who is healthy and likely to outlive the battery life of their device. It's essential to discuss the risks and benefits of each option with your healthcare team. Ask how your health, heart function, infection risk, age, lifestyle, and mobility might affect the benefits and risks of the implantable cardiac devices you're considering. Talk about the reasons behind your care team's recommendations for lead or leadless technology, number of leads, and lead placement. In addition, find out how long the battery will likely last, what to expect during your recovery, how you might expect to feel once the device is implanted, the health conditions and symptoms the device will and won't solve, the follow-up care you'll need and where you can receive it, who will remotely monitor the device, and the limitations of living with each device. Through this discussion, you can work together to agree on the best option for your specific needs. It's also a good idea to choose a healthcare team that is experienced in the insertion of cardiac devices. Research shows that the fewest complications occur when surgery is done by cardiac electrophysiologists who insert at least 40 devices a year for 10 years or more. That's certainly a lot of food for thought when considering implantable heart devices. Now let's turn to a substance that is getting a lot of press these days and which may or may not be helpful. This article is entitled Berberine, Nature's Ozempic. Lately, there's some buzz surrounding the supplement berberine, which has sometimes been marketed as a natural version of the prescription drug semaglutide, which includes Ozempic and others. The latter has made waves in recent years for helping people lose significant amounts of weight, among other therapeutic effects. While berberine appears to offer some health benefits, calling it nature's Ozempic is misleading. To start, Ozempic and berberine work differently. Ozempic is a GLP-1 receptor agonist approved by the Food and Drug Administration. It helps people lose weight by reducing appetite, controlling insulin levels, and slowing how quickly food moves through the digestive tract. Berberine is a type of substance called an alkaloid, which naturally occurs in certain plants. Studies have found that berberine may help improve cholesterol and blood sugar levels by influencing the body's metabolism of blood sugar and fats. However, berberine is not known to act directly on hunger. In some research, participants taking berberine had decreased body mass index, or BMI, and reduced waist size. But the results have tended to be inconsistent or not clinically significant. Studies on berberine often have had small sample sizes and have varied in quality. Overall, it doesn't appear to have much impact on weight loss. Because it's a supplement, berberine isn't FDA approved or strictly regulated the same way medications are, so the quality and consistency of ingredients can vary. The bottom line? While berberine has some potential to support health, weight loss benefits are minimal, if any. If you're thinking about using it, talk with a healthcare professional first. Berberine can interact with many medications, including anti-clotting drugs and those taken for diabetes and high blood pressure. What Ozempic and berberine do have in common, is that they're not magic pills. Weight management relies on an overall healthy lifestyle. This next article is about ankle replacement and advances in surgery and outcomes. And like the implantable heart devices, it really has a lot of considerations associated with it, risks, benefits, and various options. So here we go. You played a lot of sports growing up, but badly spraining your ankle back in those glory days is a less than nostalgic reminder. You're now dealing with painful arthritis. You've tried cortisone injections, creams, massages, and more, but the stiffness and swelling still make it hard to walk. Your doctor recommends an ankle replacement. So how do you know if it's time? Is replacement for you? Over 70 million people globally have ankle osteoarthritis. The pain related to the condition can result in both physical and mental challenges. A total ankle replacement, or TAR, also known as ankle arthroplasty, can help people struggling with moderate to severe arthritis of many types. TAR usually is done when other treatments, such as anti-inflammatory medications or ankle braces, aren't able to relieve daily pain. You may be a good candidate if you are over 60, don't smoke, are at a healthy weight, don't have jobs and hobbies that require demanding physical labor, have no nerve damage in your feet, such as that caused by diabetes, and have healthy ligaments and bones around the ankle. TAR is typically recommended for people with less active lifestyles so that the new joint doesn't quickly wear out. Less active does not mean sedentary, however. This lifestyle can include low-impact movements such as golfing, swimming, cycling, walking, and yoga. So let's look at the risks and rewards. Outcomes have improved since TAR was first implemented in 1973. The surgery has gained recognition as an effective solution thanks to advancing technology and understanding of ankle biomechanics. But any complex surgery comes with potential risks. Common side effects of the surgery may include numbness and swelling around the ankle, which can last for a few weeks to months. The anesthesia used in surgery can cause nausea, drowsiness, vomiting, and dry mouth for a day or two. There also is some risk of infection and nerve injury and postoperative pain. Everyone and every surgery is different. TAR can be a long-term solution, but the implants can wear out over time. However, new implant designs have reduced this risk. Total ankle replacement continues to evolve with new porous metals on the implants and designs to increase bone ingrowth, says Dr. Norman Turner III, MD, an orthopedic surgeon at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Bone ingrowth is the formation of bone tissue within the surface of an implant, which is essential for the anchoring and success of the artificial joint. With new implants and careful patient selection, outcomes continue to improve. Ankle arthrodesis, also known as joint fusion, is another surgical option for arthritis in the ankle. In this procedure, the bones of the ankle are fused together using metal plates and screws. It usually is performed on younger people and those with poor bone quality or severe joint damage. While fusion used to be considered the gold standard surgery and can help with arthritis pain, it reduces joint motion. TAR can better preserve mobility, give you a more typical walking pattern, and put less stress on nearby joints. Avoiding repetitive high-impact activity is advisable after total ankle replacement, so if you are highly active, you may benefit from an ankle fusion instead of replacement, says Taylor Bears, MD, an orthopedic surgeon with Mayo Clinic Health System. Ankle replacement is a viable surgical alternative to ankle fusion in many people. Advancements in person-specific 3D printed alignment guides have improved our ability to implant ankles in a safe and less invasive way. Before surgery, your healthcare team examines your ankle with imaging to better understand your needs and form a treatment plan. The TAR procedure is performed within about 2 hours. The surgery team removes the ends of the damaged bones and replaces them with parts made of titanium and plastic. Your surgeon chooses the prosthetic devices specifically for you. This new artificial joint helps the ankle maintain movement and decreases the chance of arthritis developing in nearby joints. In order for the ankle to continue to bend and straighten, all of the main tendons and ligaments are left in place. So what about the road to recovery after this surgery? Most people are able to resume regular daily activities within 3 to 4 months of surgery. The ankle is protected in a splint cast or boot for 4 to 12 weeks, allowing it to heal properly. You might use crutches or other mobility aids to help stabilize your movements until you're able to resume weight-bearing activities. In addition to managing pain and mobility, your healthcare team can help you learn how to care for yourself after surgery. When you return home, caregiver support is recommended for the first 1 to 2 weeks. Keeping your cast elevated above your heart throughout the day can reduce swelling. When you're able, moving around for 10 minutes every hour, you are awake, can help prevent blood clots. Try not to get discouraged by the temporary decrease in activity while recovering. There are many ways to remain active and get outside with your new ankle in the years to come with lower impact movements such as walking, dancing, water aerobics, and snowshoeing. A physical therapist can create a rehabilitation program that's right for you and your goals. People usually have significant improvement in pain and function after the surgery, Dr. Turner says. The goal is for the implants to last a lifetime. Our last article for today is about the correlation between serious falls and the risk of dementia. Falls are the leading cause of injury among older adults. Could they also be an early indicator of cognitive decline? A new study found that a diagnosis of dementia in older adults was more likely within 1 year after they had a serious fall. The study looked at data from almost 2.5 million adults aged 66 and older who did not have an existing dementia diagnosis but had a traumatic injury that caused them to go to the emergency room or to be hospitalized. About half of them, or 1.2 million, were injured by a fall. Those who had fallen were 21% more likely to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or related dementia in the year next year compared with those whose injuries were due to something else. Just over 10%, about 130,000, were diagnosed with some form of dementia within the next year. The researchers who conducted the study, which was published in JAMA Network Open, noted that the results could not directly link falls and dementia. They emphasized that some of the people may have had undiagnosed dementia at the time of their falls or had mild cognitive impairment that progressed to dementia afterwards. But the researchers say their findings suggest that having older adults undergo cognitive screening after a serious fall might help to detect dementia sooner. Mayo Clinic experts say more research is needed to better understand the connection between falls and dementia. If you or a loved one recently had a serious fall, talk with your healthcare team about whether cognitive screening would be a good idea. It's also important to discuss how you can prevent further falls. Well, sadly, that's all for this week. I hope you'll tune in next week. I'm going to be talking about 6 science-backed ways to protect and improve your memory. In addition, we'll look at some new Parkinson's research that's very promising, although very new and a long way from treatment. And we'll talk about some debunking some of the myths in the cholesterol wars. So thank you again for tuning in. Be sure to listen next week. I hope very much that you've enjoyed it. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. I'd really love to hear from you. Are these topics are they relevant for you? Are there topics you'd like to hear more about? Is there information you've found particularly helpful? Would love to hear a story about that. Or just let me know that you're listening. That would mean a lot. That number again is 919-832-5138. As always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.